I want my country back, and the country I'm talking about would not tolerate this nonsense.
But now you have a choice. There is a party that will represent you and stand up for common sense.
And when the dam bursts, it will do so spectacularly.
I overturned the biggest ever Conservative majority of 25,500 people.
But if Britain is broken, then logically, Britain needs reform.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to the second edition of the Reform Party podcast. For my second victim, I have a man who I met as we were electioneering for the parliamentary elections last year. I found him an interesting character, and I wanted to find out more about him. So I've got him here, and could I welcome, please, Nick Goulding.
Hi, Nick.
Lovely to meet you. Again.
Right. Do you want to start off perhaps just by telling people a little bit about your background, where you were born, what you've done in life, we'll take it from there.
Well, I was born in Hong Kong, a child of the empire, you might say. And then my father was in the Royal Navy, lived in various places around the globe. I then will leap to when I left school, I went to join the army and then went off to university. I did a politics degree in Bristol University. In fact, I started doing politics and economics, but I couldn't agree with the economics lecturers, all of whom were recently retired advisors to the outgoing Callaghan government.
So were they all Keynesian economists, is that the problem?
They were more on the Keynesian side, and I was a little monetarist, you might say.
Yeah.
And we didn't see eye to eye. The problem really was that I wouldn't accept what they said as gospel, and they were prepared to push the point. And this became desperately unpopular with everyone else on the course, who, like sheep, were happy to accept what they were told without question and carry on. And when I saw that this was proving unpopular, I decided to leave the economics course and concentrate on politics, where I was able to spend a lot of time playing rugby for the university, five-a-side football. I did student community action, visiting the DHSS, as it then was, rehabilitation centre, driving people to Riding for the Disabled, and actually everything other than my degree, which I eventually got.
Well, I think you'll find a lot of people who went to universities in the 70s and 80s had that sort of university career. I did English literature, and I think in the whole course I read three books. So you're not alone in that.
No, but I then did have a bit of a culture shock, because computers were emerging on the scene at that stage. We'd not particularly seen computers at school. Insofar as we had a picture of computers, they were some vast room with flashing lights and men with white coats, lab style, with massive whirring discs.
Yes, I remember.
And so on.
I remember them.
Well, I thought, well, clearly these computers are the way forward, whatever they might be. So I applied to do a master's degree in computer science, which was essentially the bachelor's degree compressed into 1 year. And entirely unlike politics, I actually had to work hard for the whole year, which was a complete shock to the system, although I did scrape by and get that degree.
Yeah, well, I did the same. I did a one-year course in accountancy after finishing my degree. And as you see, that was a big culture shock.
So anyway, having done that, I then went off and did a short service commission with the Gloucestershire Regiment, which is sadly no more. But my interest was always in politics, not necessarily party politics, but politics more generally. And I had brought to my attention a job working for a small business organisation called the Association of Independent Businesses. And I took that opportunity, went to work for them, where I learned a lot about the realities of business and the impact of politics on
small businesses. So this was before your army career?
No, this was after I'd left.
Right.
But in parallel to my civilian career, I continued with the army in the territorial army.
Right, I'm with you.
Where I was in the Wessex Regiment and then the Royal Anglian Regiment and the Royal Logistic Corps. And I commanded various subunits, company level organizations. And I commanded a regiment, a large complex supply regiment, which had a whole range of functions. It had bulk petroleum, it had vehicle specialists, it had ammunition technicians, and most usefully of all, it had the Army's Reserve of Bath and Laundry units, which were always popular once they were in the field.
I'm sure.
And then my final tour with the Territorial Army was a mobilised tour in Baghdad, where I had a more complicated title, but essentially I fronted up the media operations in Baghdad, the headquarters of the multinational force Iraq.
Very good, very good. That is interesting.
But anyway, back to my civilian career. After a couple of years working for the Association of Independent Businesses, where I had a real grounding in the issues and concerns for business, how taxation policy, how employment law, how health and safety regulations, and the whole gamut of the way that governments interact with businesses can create the conditions for growth, or alternatively, can stymie growth. I moved on from there to a larger organisation called the Forum of Private Business, where I became first a lobbyist, a policy officer, then the head of policy, and then finally the chief executive. And in that guise there, I was instrumental in pushing through a whole series of laws, both at Westminster level and in the European Union. So, for example, at Westminster level, statutory sick pay used to work in a slightly different basis than now, whereby the government would reimburse employers for the statutory sick pay that they paid out, whereas now employers have to pocket that whole cost themselves.
Yeah.
However, at the point that the statutory sick pay buck was being passed to business, the government was proposing to bring in a small business relief scheme. It's just that the small business relief scheme that they were proposing wasn't really fit for purpose, for the simple reason that government and the officials do not understand how businesses work and the impact of their policies on individual employees and businesses.
Yeah. Well, we'll come on to that, because I wanted to talk to you about the recent budget that has been delivered by the Labour Party. So that will be very relevant. But could we just move on to a little bit about your political career, your political background? I noticed when Nigel came up to see us in Frodsham early last year that when he recognised you, and I gathered from that he must have known you from some time in the political past, and I'm guessing that might have been UKIP, is that right?
No, it wasn't party political. This was, again, in my guise as a lobbyist for businesses. Every time there was a general election, we used to go and interview a senior people, either the Prime Minister or the Chancellor of the Exchequer or their shadows, and the leaders of the main opposition parties.
Yeah.
And I would go with them, as you are with me now, and do an interview with them, which was very interesting because it gave you an access to people right at the top, and they were trying to present their vision as to how they would be better for business, and particularly better for small businesses. But we decided to include UKIP, and this was a general election.
And this was when Nigel was heading up UKIP.
I think he may not have actually been head at the time, but he was a senior member. It was probably something like the 93 general election. I have to say, time and tide passes on, but it was sometime in the mid-90s when there was a general election.
Right.
But I don't think it wasn't the 97 general election, so it must have been the one before that. And I met him at a hotel just north of Market Drayton, where he'd just been holding a UKIP meeting where they had approximately four people attending. So where he's gone from a meeting with four people to the massive audiences he commands now is such a sort of way through history. But so I met him then, and I was also in my lobbying guys backwards and forwards to Brussels, maybe a couple of times a week. And so I used to very regularly meet the UK MEPs and the UK officials in Brussels. And in that guise, I ran into him a fair amount.
I see. That's very disappointing, though, because I'm now going to have to delete all my UKIP section that I thought you could tell us about.
Oh, well, no, I was a Conservative all the way through that time.
Right.
But I was a Conservative who was sympathetic to the views of UKIP. I particularly remember when John Major was still Prime Minister, a session over in Europe when the European Commission and various member state heads of government were. So it was a European Council meeting. And I asked John Major about the ratchet effect, whereby laws are brought in, you can agree them once, but after that, they're locked in space and there's nothing much you can do about it. And the dismissal that I had from John Major and his complete absence of understanding of the democratic deficit, which was implicit in the way the European Union was organised, is what really set me on the path to supporting UK exit from the European Union.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people were in that boat. You said that you had been press officer in Baghdad.
Well, a little bit more than press officer. I doubled up as the embassy press attaché because it was vacant at the time. And that was quite an interesting experience because my time filling that role coincided with Gordon Brown's official visit to Baghdad. So I got to coordinate the Baghdad end of the media management of a prime ministerial visit, which gave me a good insight into the way the spinning that's going on in the background. And, you know, I was party to a lot of the discussions that Gordon Brown was having with his officials because I was an anonymous sort of military figure sort of lurking in the background. But there you go. It did give me an interesting insight.
I knew Gordon Brown. I used to play football with him when his father was the rector in Hamilton in Scotland. And I also knew him when he was at university in Edinburgh.
Well, I'll tell you my Gordon Brown, my number one Gordon Brown story. I was in 1997 standing in the queue in McDonald's in St Albans, and the phone went, and I picked up the phone while you're standing in the queue at McDonald's, and this voice said, "Hello, Nick, it's Gordon here." And I wasn't quite sure what this Gordon was. So this conversation went backwards and forwards a bit while I was trying to work out who on earth this Gordon was. It turned out it was Gordon Brown wanting to remonstrate with me that we put out a press release about aspects of the Labour Party policies in their manifesto saying that they didn't add up. And he wanted to explain to me why they really did add up. And that really illustrates the difference between the Labour Party when it arrived in 1997 and the Labour Party which has now fallen into government by default, you might say, in 2024.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't a big fan of the Labour government in 1997, but you had to take your hat off to the preparation, the dedication they had to the fine detail of everything, and they had dug into all of their policies. They knew the arguments as to how it was going to have this impact or that impact. You could have a sensible discussion with them. They might disagree with you and they might actually go off in different directions, but you couldn't fault them on their preparation and the diligence with which they went about it. Unlike the present lot, that seemed to have no idea as to what they were going to do, how they were going to do it, or the impact of what they were going to do once they decided to do it.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any question that if you try to compare the calibre of the people of the New Labour at that time You look, I mean, everyone was high caliber, quality individual, whatever you thought of the politics. And you compare that with the cabinet that we have now, it's chalk and cheese.
They were. And they'd also had the sense to prepare in terms of having some oven-ready policies that they could put in place when they arrived. And we took advantage of that by presenting them with some oven-ready policies where we weren't entirely eye to eye with the then Conservative government. And we got several measures, including the statutory right to interest on late paid commercial debt,
yep,
that was brought in. And that was a piece of legislation that I was largely instrumental in drafting.
And made a difference to a lot of companies.
And it does, as ever with these things, people have to understand what's there to better use it. But nevertheless, it was a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
But it does show how a well-organised political party can arrive in power and make some real differences straight away. An object lesson to the present government, which has failed to learn any of those lessons.
Absolutely, yeah. I couldn't agree more. Going back to Baghdad, what now is your view of what happened? And that was effectively, it will always haunt Tony Blair. But what's your view of the rectitude of the war?
Well, I'm no fan of Saddam Hussein. He was a ghastly dictator, and I think the world was better off not having him. Having said that, I think the way in which we sold the objectives of the war were wrong and were based on a lie, and that's never good. And secondly, the way in which we went, and I say we broadly in terms of the coalition as a whole, I mean, principally the Americans, but we were their main sidekick. The way that occupation proceeded was a case study in how not to occupy a country. And it created the conditions which led to the insurgency as we attempted to dictate our mores and values based on hundreds of years of political development. And that same factor was even worse in Afghanistan, which you might say was several centuries behind Iraq.
Well, I mean, this is the point. We always seem to enter these wars without any real strategy for what happens afterwards. We see somebody we don't like, a dictator or whatever, and we say, okay, we've had enough now, we're going to go. But they don't think through what the exit strategy is. I mean, exactly the same thing happened a few years later in Libya.
Definitely.
And as you see, Afghanistan was the worst. We fought, you know, to see our, you must feel it more being an army man than I did. But, you know, when you saw reports time after time, a young man blown apart with an improvised explosive device for a war that you knew was never going to be won and didn't really have any point to it.
Well, essentially, in the end, in Iraq, we acknowledged that by withdrawing to the airport and sealing ourselves in. And ignoring what was going on around, because we knew that, none of the generals would have put it like this, but the reality was we could expend as much gold and blood as we wanted to in Basra, and it wouldn't make any difference to the outcome in Baghdad.
No.
If the Americans won in Baghdad, then you'd by default win in Basra. If the Americans lost in Baghdad, then you were going to lose in Basra.
Yeah.
So because our government wasn't prepared to commit the resources you would need to dominate the battlefield and actually secure the conditions which, in theory, we were looking for, in the absence of that resource and in the absence of ability to dictate what was going on in Baghdad, it made total sense to occupy a position of minimising our casualties.
Mm. Okay. There was a case the other day whereby a human rights lawyer who had been involved in basically canvassing in Iraq for stories of people, and when he couldn't find the right stories to denigrate our troops, he made them up. And he got very large sums of public money expended on for him to then fight these cases in the UK courts. Now, when this was all exposed, and a man called Shiner,
yeah,
and when this was all exposed, he didn't even go to prison. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think there's a whole travesty. He created a nightmare for lots of soldiers
absolutely.
Who were facing the possibility of disciplinary action that could have led them going to jail, and it was all a put-up job.
Yeah.
It really tells you quite a lot about the perverse effects of the so-called human rights legislation, which often achieves the precise reverse of the intention that we have. And the Americans haven't got anything like as far down that road as we have. My own view is we should return to a position where the United Kingdom determines its rules and the way in which we are governed, and we should have no truck with foreign powers, be they collective or individual, dictating how UK citizens are ruled.
But do you think in this case that would have made any difference? Because our judicial system is set up in a way whereby it can be exploited by this sort of thing. And he was presumably claiming legal aid for the people involved and so on, and racking up a bill. Now, unless we change, we have a government that's prepared to change that, then we're not going to get much further.
Well, there are two aspects to that. You're right, the government needs to have the resolve to do it. Mm. But actually, while you're tied up with the Human Rights Act and the European Convention on Human Rights, in a way that we weren't, although we were signatories, it wasn't within UK law until Tony Blair brought it in. The hands of the UK government were essentially tied by itself. Mm. So first you have to get out of that.
Yep.
Then it's a necessary condition that the government has the resolve to actually retake that control. And then if we make stupid decisions and we leave our troops exposed, we know exactly who to blame, and that's our own government. And it's that accountability to the politicians that we need to restore.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You say, you know, we'll leave EHCR, but what do we if we then replace it with something just as stupid, then we haven't really made any progress. I mean, this is what happened really with Brexit and immigration. We said that we were going to stop immigration and take back control. Now, we took the power to do that, but then we didn't do it.
Well, we actually did the precise reverse. We took back the power and then we opened the floodgates. Mm. And that's the not conservatives for you. The problem with a lot of this is that within government, there's a established set of views which are held in common by most of the elected politicians that we have in Westminster, mm. and certainly by the officials who run the ministries. And where you've got that situation, it is virtually impossible for a government to shift unless they've got the strength in their backbenches to change the rules and reset where we are. That's why Prime Minister Truss was always on a hiding to nothing. I think she was partly the author of her own misfortune, but nevertheless, I think that it's also true that there may not have been a conspiracy in the sense that people met in darkened rooms, but there was a collective desire to prevent her from implementing the policies that she set out.
Well, I think, Nick, if you look at it in detail, I think there was a conspiracy, because I think that the way that the Bank of England manipulated the situation in order to have the bond yields explode and get rid of her was quite deliberate, in my view.
It may have been deliberate from the Bank of England. I mean, I don't want to be semantic about it, but a conspiracy implies that there's a collective will to action. But I don't think it needed that collective will to action. The various actors who carried out the actions that led to that result were doing what they thought was right based on how they understood the world. The fact is, though, in my opinion, the way they understand that is entirely wrong. I think it's highly unlikely that there was some controlling brain that was dictating how this conspiracy was going to unfold. But you might say, why does it matter? Because the net effect,
yeah, the effect was the same. I agree.
The same.
This is the problem you have with a quick chat about this with David last week about conspiracy theories. And a conspiracy theory is only a conspiracy theory as long as it's proven to be false. Once you have a conspiracy theory that you can prove to be true, it's no longer a conspiracy theory, it's a fact.
And there's also the old adage that just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean to say...
Wait, who said I was paranoid?
It doesn't mean to say that there isn't that they're not out to get you.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that sort of thing goes round and round in circles. But the bottom line really is that there are so many divorced positions of power that are not accountable through Parliament that a government will always be second-guessed. And the problem for the Conservative Party, where there are some politicians that do occasionally venture support for policies that I would think are more sensible, have no chance of implementing it, because quite aside from this establishment being opposed to it, their own backbench colleagues will not support them in doing it.
Indeed.
And so any Conservative leader, however sensible, is doomed to failure because of the stable that he sits in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Truss, although she got elected, she was elected by the membership of the Tory party, not by the MPs. And I don't think she ever had the support of the MPs.
No, that's very true. I mean, she had the support of enough MPs to get on the ballot, but that wasn't enough to remain in office.
Correct.
I mean, I think time and time again, my view is that the rank and file membership of the Conservative Party are decent people who want the best for the country. The problem is they've put their trust and their hope in a set of charlatans who have no intention of delivering it. When Theresa May said about the nasty party, she was referring to the members, but she had it precisely the wrong way round. It's true the Conservative Party was the nasty party, but the nasty party was the elected officials betraying their members, not the grassroots members.
Theresa May's almost her last act in government was putting net zero into law, and that's been her legacy.
Well, if you look at pretty well all of the bonkers policies which the present government is carrying forward, they have their roots in the Conservative government.
Right.
There's nothing that they've thought of that the Conservatives hadn't thought about inflicting on people first.
Let's go back to the army, because I'm particularly interested in that. And we have a policy in Reform UK whereby we are going to increase the percentage of GDP that we spend on defence from, at the moment, I think it's less than 2%. And our aim is to get it initially to 3% and perhaps even to 4%. Do you think that's going to work? Do you think that there's enough recruitment capability in the army to achieve a standing army of more than, as we have at the moment, 75,000?
Well, I think you need to come back from that question and think what the armed forces are trying to achieve and where the numbers are what you want.
Or are the numbers of whether the numbers are important?
Well, numbers do have a strength of their own, but we have to consider where we are as a maritime power. The last 50 years, with our strength of armed force focusing on Europe, is very much detached from the totality of our history. We are still a trading nation, and it's in our interests that those trading interests are properly defended. Of course, we do have to support our allies in NATO, but we also need to be able to project power outside the NATO area to ensure that the United Kingdom's legitimate interests alongside our allies, and particularly our principal ally, the United States, are properly protected. And so the army needs to have the scale to be able to generate forces that can be used either in Europe or elsewhere. But what that also implies is that the Royal Navy, particularly with the confrontation with China, but also with the pirates in the Arabian Sea, and the obstruction by Iran in the Gulf of Hormuz, and there are various checkpoints that come up that need the Royal Navy to be able to demonstrate that the United Kingdom can deploy force across the areas of its interest in the world, and not least the strategic deterrent, but also the Royal Air Force clearly have a role in delivering that. And in terms of supporting our allies in Europe, the RAF also has a particularly prevalent role. But armed forces are changing at the moment. The role of drones that you will have seen most lately in the Ukraine, but also in other wars such as in Armenia, where drones are deployed by the Azerbaijanis, were the principal vehicle of their lightning victories.
So the fact that we only, in inverted commas, have 75,000 soldiers is not necessarily a terrible thing.
I actually think we do want to have some expansion in the army's numbers, but I don't think we need to have hundreds of thousands. But I was going to come on to one of the reasons that we don't attract the recruits that we used to is partly the conditions in which, in this day and age, soldiers are asked to live, which is not up to standard, and we need to address that sort of thing, and the way in which we reintegrate veterans into society and recognise them as such, where I would suggest the Americans are probably better than we are, but also the language we use. If you're talking about the army, when it comes to closing with and killing the enemy, you need to have a certain type of person. And we've been good over the last generations in being able to deploy the sort of people.
We need a Paddy Mayne.
You do need a certain number of Paddy Maynes, probably not so many, but you need to have a structure which generates your Paddy Maynes. And at the moment, our language paints a completely different picture as to the sort of person we want. You've only got to look at the RAF's recruiting scandal, where they tried to remove white males from their recruiting target. The army is not immune, and the armed forces more generally are not immune from DEI. I think that the generals and admirals and air marshals are not quite as, but many of them are some way down the same route that we see so many of our senior officials.
Let me put something that's maybe a little bit more controversial to you, in that my view is that by the time kids have come through school, university, probably not, whatever, but by the time they get to the age of 18 and you may want to recruit them into the armed forces, we're not going to do it, because they've already had so much pushed, shoved down the throat in terms of the what a terrible country this is. Why would any of them want to fight for it?
Well, we do need to rectify that situation, and that's somewhere that Reform UK will speak strongly to people. And particularly, it's the role of young men that the culture that has dominated the public sector have denigrated. So it's hardly surprising that you see young men feeling alienated from society. And really, historically, it's the young men that should be the bedrock, not only of our defence, but of our economy. Because the reality is, they will spend longer in the workforce and they will work longer hours. And yes, we want to ensure that women have opportunities, but not in a way that belittles men and reduces their opportunity. It also goes to the whole question about the family structure, the way in which so many young boys are in households that don't have a male in it, and preferably their natural father. And one of those policies that particularly attracts me to Reform, that you will see in the contract, is the emphasis on providing greater support for families to encourage, at the moment, taxation, benefits, the education system, they all push the legal system, the divorce laws. These are all custom made to undermine families. Now, that's not to say you can force two people who don't want to stay together to stay together, and that's not what I'm suggesting. But where the state puts its incentives should be to encourage family units to get together and remain together, not least because that is the very best thing for children. And all the studies show that where you have families that have stayed together, the outcomes for children are significantly better. And that is something government should be encouraging, not undermining.
Absolutely, I agree with that. But do you think, in general, we talked last week about the lack of patriotism that's generally felt now by comparison with how it was, say, in 1940. Do you think that there are actually enough people, enough kids out there who would be prepared to pick up a rifle, go into war, and potentially die for their country?
Well, I'm more optimistic than you are, although I think that the government and the establishment is doing its best to undermine it. If you cast your mind back to, I forget it was 35 or 36, when the Oxford Union debated the question as to this House would not take up arms to defend Britain, which motion passed. So that sort of thought is not new. And yet when we came to a war with Hitler and the rightness of our cause was apparent to the population, those that chose not to were a vanishingly small minority. Now, the problem we have at the moment is we have allowed fractures to develop within our society, where there are elements of our society that do not conform with the mainstream views of society. But if I restrict my comments to the mainstream part of society, and this is not a question of the colour of your skin, it's a question of those people who feel that Britain is the right place and support the traditional values of fairness and equal dealings that we have here, and don't like to see bullies winning around the place. Those sorts of people, I think, will step forward. I meet a lot of young people, and I am always impressed. If I listen to what I hear on the media about young people, and I took that as gospel, I'd be a lot more depressed than I am when I meet actual young people.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, Nick, and that cheers me up no end, because that's, as you say, not the impression that we're getting from mainstream media, is it?
Well, those elements of our society, I mean, the bedrock of the armed forces were the traditional working class. They provided the numbers.
Yeah.
And not that other people didn't step forward, but in terms of the numbers, that's where it came from. Mm. And when you look at those same boys, the ones that are being excluded from school, and
does that, in a sense, if they are feeling isolated and excluded and so on, does that kind of push them more towards an army career?
Well, there's a minority that go that way. But for those that do take it, it can be a real saving grace. Mm. Many people who've come from fractured households,
the army
find,
made me,
they can find a unity, a strength in being part of a wider family of people that replaces what they didn't have in the first place. But really, as a society, we need to make sure that they do have that in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, when people were coming into the army years ago, it isn't that they came from perfect backgrounds. It wasn't that their civilian life was a bed of roses. In fact, in many ways, what young people experience in their life now is a lot softer in that sense than the school of hard knocks that applied previously. And yet those people in previous generations were able to step forward. And I have no doubt that the people in the current... You have to deal with people as individuals and how they are. So I'm not saying that the army should be treating the recruits of today in the same way as they were in the 50s.
No.
Because I don't think that would get the best out of those people. But in terms of recognising and encouraging them to support their country, to believe in Britain, to be prepared to put their life on the line for Britain, knowing that their country will back them, is exactly the sense that we want them to feel.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you could do that, then great. I just wonder whether or not our country really has got their back these days.
I think that these human rights lawyers like Shiner you were describing are precisely the sort of symptom in society which undermines that sort of thing. But the same is true of the school teacher who talks down the historic contribution of Britain. Britain is the greatest force for good that the world has ever seen. You've only got to look at the role we played in the Industrial Revolution, and the much maligned colonial empire actually brought people out of poverty. It removed them from lives of suspicion.
Abolished slavery.
It did, and if it wasn't for the money and gold which the British Empire has had expended in the 19th century, slavery would have a continued and much stronger hold, because many other powers didn't want to get rid of slavery.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about European powers, I'm talking about powers across Africa and Asia who reluctantly were dragged away from slavery at the point of a British bayonet.
Right, moving on to a Reform UK's policy on veterans.
Yeah.
We have quite a strong policy in veterans to say we want to help veterans, but it's a bit, to my mind, a bit woolly. There's not enough detail in it in terms of exactly the things that we would do to help people go back into society once they leave the forces.
One of the problems we have at the moment is the numbers, because if you went back when we had a larger armed forces, the local support networks for veterans were that much more pronounced. Now, many veterans are well prepared for civilian life, but it's clear there is a element amongst the veterans who, some of them may have been institutionalized to a sense.
And traumatized them.
Some of them may be suffering from PTSD and so on, which is much better controlled when you're amongst other people who've shared similar experiences than when you're cast into a wider society that doesn't understand the experience that you have had. I mean, and in years gone by, pretty well every town and many villages had their Royal British Legion club, where at a simple level you could go for a quiet pint and you knew that other people there knew what the score was. Those are much fewer on the ground. There are some good organisations out there reaching out, but many of the problems which veterans suffer in terms of housing, in terms of access to employment and support into employment, are problems which apply more broadly to people in society. So, yes, I think veterans deserve that extra hand up because what they've been prepared to offer to the country. But equally, I'd say that most of the problems that veterans suffer from are best resolved by resolving the issues that face us more generally. Given that, where you've got veterans that fall through the net, we should be clear that there's a safety net to pick them up.
But I mean, the main problem, it seems to me, that veterans have is, first of all, as you say, getting back into society in terms of job and housing, and because housing's a big thing if they've been in army houses all their lives. But also, there does seem to be an element whereby I don't particularly like this PTSD thing. I don't like any of these acronyms very, very much. But certainly, there's no question that when people come out of having been in Afghanistan or in a fighting situation, that a lot of them are traumatized by what they've seen, by what they've done, perhaps. And these are the people who you see in a bus shelter and they get involved in alcohol and substance abuse. It's a familiar pattern that happens again and again and again.
It can certainly be a factor in individuals, and particularly where that trauma is a result of their military service, we're letting them down.
We are.
By not picking that up. In many cases, their needs are complex. They may resist assistance. I remember Actually, during the general election, I regularly bumped into an individual in the middle of Chester who turns out to have been a next serviceman. I did offer to signpost him to services that would assist him, but he was vehement that that's not what he wanted. And you can't force assistance on someone who doesn't want it, because they are agents of their own destiny, and they need to be given that agency. I think perhaps we should try to minimise people coming into that situation by looking at the exit arrangements from the armed forces to ensure that people who are vulnerable in that way have appropriate support before they may have fallen off any cliff. And we should be also preparing society so that before people go into the armed forces, we've already engendered many of the issues which I think that reform can do in terms of the moral factor in society, making people feel better about being British at a really simple level, which makes it easier to cope with some of the other vagaries that get thrown at you. If you feel that you've been doing a good thing in the Army or the Air Force or the Royal Navy, and you feel better about yourself all round, that will help you in how you approach life.
Good, right. Well, let's leave the Army and let's move on to talk a little bit about the small businesses and to talk a little bit about the budget, which Rachel Reeves introduced a few weeks ago. I have an interest in a small business, and when I ran the figures for next year by comparison with what we've done this year, and I looked at the effect that was going to have by both the national insurance contributions, the raising of the minimum wage, because it's a hospitality business, so we have a lot of people working at on or near minimum wage, and also the cancellation of the rate relief on business rates. When I factored all these things and put them into the computer, what you find that instead of making a small profit, as we will this year, next year, factoring these new factors in, we're going to make a significant loss. Now, as a business owner, what do I do about that? I mean, the logical, sensible thing is, okay, you might want to try and raise prices and so on to ameliorate the effects of the budget. But the sensible thing really is to say, why am I working hard like this to try and make money? And the only people that are gaining out of it is the state. All the money is going back to the government in taxation. Now, if I do the logical thing and close the business, the state won't get any of that money. And there must be thousands in exactly the same position up and down the country.
I think what you've illustrated and what you said there is that the core of the problem isn't actually in the detailed policies, but the collective effect of those policies and the general tenor of the government in talking the economy down and the way in which the money markets have responded to that. And we see the present spike in borrowing rates so that the government is having to pay more in debt interest than it pays for education, for example. Mm. And that's been the net effect of both Conservative and Labour governments, because we have the inheritance of the mismanagement of both parties. And that's probably the biggest effect on businesses. As the general level of economic activity stagnates and possibly even depresses, so your demand goes down.
Yep.
At the same time, your costs are going up. The employer's national insurance contribution doesn't directly affect many small firms because you do have an allowance, even though the threshold has been brought down to £5,000. Yeah. But nevertheless, you still do have an individual allowance against that. So the very smallest firms won't be directly affected, but they will be indirectly affected, because when there's a reduction in activity by larger firms who take on fewer employees, who do less because their costs are going, that necessarily has an impact on the smallest firms because they engage with the larger firms. Business rates is one that really stings the smallest businesses. And every time business rates goes up by whatever mechanism, it will have a severe negative impact on employment, because it will push more business onto the internet, where the value both of the trade and the employment is offshored in many cases, or concentrated in delivery centres, which are very efficient and so on, but they're not employing local people. And so you end up in a doom spiral.
Well, but that's where we're heading, isn't it? I mean, if there are, I assume that there will be absolutely thousands of people up and down the country in exactly the same position as me, running the figures through, saying, just a minute, these figures don't make, I can't make any money. So the rational thing to do in those circumstances is to close the business down, do something else.
Either close the business down or refocus how it operates to minimise your costs. Can you lose that one or two employees at the margin? Can you offshore some of your support activities? Can you make that one employee that you keep more efficient, and you get rid of the other two? There are all sorts of ways.
Can I get robots to deliver the meals instead of staff?
That sort of thing. And can you dispose with the staff at the till, because everyone's using the automated machines at the exit from the supermarkets? And you can see that sort of thing. I mean, and if you were Tesco's or Sainsbury's or any of those other Morrison's, any of those other big supermarkets, those employees are a big fixed cost. So if you can shift some of those and get people either shopping online or using the automated tills, then you're going to do it. Although I would say there's a cautionary note in that, which is that levels of shrinkage from stores that have gone so far down automation have gone up. And at the same time, as the police are apparently disregarding shoplifting below an astronomical threshold, then why wouldn't people shoplift when the opportunity presents themselves? Now, many people wouldn't, but there's a strata of people who perhaps might take that opportunity. And you can see that in that shrinkage rate. I mean, one thing you haven't mentioned, which is really a propellant of the business issues that we have, is net zero, where the costs, direct and indirect, of net zero are slaughtered. We've seen the chemical industry suffering.
Grangemouth just closed.
And that is true across a whole range of industries. The costs of fuel makes an impact, whether it's heating fuel, electricity, or vehicle fuel, clearly has a big impact on businesses.
So how do you think it's going to go? Because clearly there's no appetite in the Labour Party or the Labour government for doing anything about the net zero targets. You know, it doesn't appear there's any sign of a U-turn. So therefore you have a situation whereby we have no car industry, we have no chemical industry, we have no the industrial degeneration across the whole of the country is going to be massive. And as we move towards it, it's only a few years away, 2030. As we move towards that, where do you think it's going? The two things can't happen. Something's got to give. What do you think will give?
Well, what I earnestly pray is that there'll be enough left by 2029 for us to resuscitate. But I do think that the British economy has underlying strengths in the skills of its people, so that although the Labour government may run the economy down, and I think it will, I do also believe that the initiative and the drive of the British people will allow us to recover from that, because we have some real underlying strengths, and you can't wipe that out in 4 years. And so individual industries may disappear off. I mean, you've just got to paint yourself back to Germany in 1945, where if you want to see total destruction, it's difficult to exceed that in its totality.
Yeah.
And that was left was being carted off by the Russians and the French back to France and Russia. And yet, by 1952, the German economy was really starting to motor. And by the late 50s, it was a miracle of economic success. So do I think that the effect of the present net zero lunacy will be fatal for our country? I think it'll be damaging, but I don't think it'll be fatal. But what I hope it'll do is bring people to their senses so they elect a government that's prepared to remove those shackles, to have a policy that brings in nuclear and gas to allow us to power a significant reduction in energy costs, so that, like the United States, we drive energy costs down, which means larger industries become much more effective, and across the whole economy, people are energized to actually invest because they've got a faith in the long-term future. So I don't think that with the best will in the world, the present government is going to achieve a positive outcome for our industries, and we will see particular sectors suffering badly, but that Britain will be able to recover from it.
Well, I hope you're right, because, I mean, assuming that we do take over in 2029, as I think all the indicators show at the moment is quite likely, we do have to have something there that we can start with to save Britain. And I'm not as concerned as you that perhaps the it will be, I'm more concerned than you that there will be enough there to save.
Well, what you can't remove is the energy of the people, and we have a lot of people with a lot of experience. At a simple level, if Britain becomes an economy that removes the shackles that obstruct business and industry, then not only will the people that are here be enabled to actually step forward, but many people who've left this country and are outside here and are looking for opportunity will return, and the money will return here when the clear business opportunities.
But by that time, will the socialists not have effectively destroyed us by not having the people available to come through? I mean, in 1945, the German engineering was still strong after the war, and so therefore they had the capability, the people, to rebuild their economy. Now, what have we got in terms of
Well, just to take issue with that. In 1945, the German factories were flat on the floor.
But they had engineering expertise to quickly get them back going again.
Their male population was down by some 4 million, some of whom were drifting back, but many of which were never to return. And that portion of their working population was also deeply traumatized, dislocated, and nevertheless, in the worst possible circumstances, you might say, and yet they managed to recover. They brought it on themselves, and then they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. And by the same token, you might say that by electing this Labour government, and before it by repeatedly electing Conservative governments without any real Conservative sense to them, we as a country have brought it on ourselves. But we sure can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and restore Britain to be. I am confident that with a reform government, Britain will be an economic envy of the world by the 2030s.
Well, let's hope you're right. How did you? You recently fought the general election back in June.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
I found the reception on the doorstep was excellent. I found the reception on the streets was excellent. I also found that the ability and the willingness of our supporters to engage was a quantum leap better than it was in 2019. Yeah. If I looked at the membership database when I fought the general election as the Brexit Party candidate in Weaver Vale, we had a similar number of supporters on the database, but only a handful that were prepared to come out and help. By the 2024 general election, you only had to pick up the phone to a supporter and they were up for helping you. And that wasn't just in Chester North. I was engaged in work with supporters in Ellesmere Port and Bootle and Warrington South and Tatton. And in all of those places, I found it was the same sort of response from our members and supporters. They were still a minority, clearly, at the time, because you can see the voting figures, the ones that voted for the Conservatives. I think the Conservatives, you have to take your hat off to their campaigning in the final stages of the general election. They were very effective in selling that message that, as they would put it, vote reform and let Labour in. But now I think the boot is very much on the other foot.
Yeah.
I couldn't have stomached supporting the Conservatives in the last election because they'd lied to us so often previously, and there was no evidence that if someone's lied to you, you know, a few times, that they're not going to carry on lying to you. And yet, 4 million people did vote for us. Our votes were largely driven by the national campaign,
indeed,
and they were particularly engendered by the arrival of
Nigel
Farage, who made a quantum difference to our ability to actually reach through.
Yes, that was one of the things I noticed, that, that almost, if I compare myself with the other seats in the world, we all fought very different campaigns. Some almost did nothing, others had 20,000 leaflets delivered and so on. And in terms of the result, the percentages, it made no difference whatsoever.
I'm convinced that's true. I'm sure that the ground game and local activity does make a difference. And I say that on the basis of having worked within the Conservative Party for a long period of time. But I don't think it makes a difference immediately.
No.
I think it makes a difference over time, where people build up the credentials in a local area and demonstrate to the local people that they are there consistently. But there were two very different general elections that we should have regard to. And apart from the 2024 general election, with our just over 4 million votes, it's also worth considering the 2015 general election, where I was a Conservative and fought as a Conservative, but UKIP got as near as, damn it, 4 million votes in 2015.
Mm.
Clearly, that was in the run-up to the Brexit referendum. But those 4 million votes or so that UKIP managed to gain under Nigel Farage was despite the national campaign.
Mm.
Because at that stage, the mainstream media did everything they could to ignore and isolate UKIP. The social media that's now so prevalent exist, but it was nothing like the same thing that it is now. But what UKIP, and I'm speaking as an outsider here, but what UKIP did have was local activists that were well organised in branches and got out and knocked on doors. And they weren't just doing it in the 2015 general election. They'd been doing it for the 10 years up to then.
Yep.
They had their street stalls, they had their leaflets, they had their newsletters.
Well, I mean, I'm new to electioneering, so I didn't know what to expect. But I, like you, was astonished at how the activists, how they contacted you. Can I, have you got more leaflets? Have you, can I come round and pick them up from your house?
Yeah.
It was all a can do thing. And I was really quite surprised at that. Now, I don't know how we best use that enthusiasm, because as you say, I'm not sure that actually the delivery of leaflets had a great impact by comparison.
But it did. The point I'm trying to make to you is, in the right circumstances, it can, because in the 2015 general election, in contrast to 2024, the main way that UKIP delivered its 4 million votes was by that local activity. But it wasn't local activity at the point of the 2015 general election.
It was in the run-up.
It was the activity, not just, but the long run-up, for the 10 years before.
So we should be starting that local activity now
in order to move towards
the 2020.
Very much so. And we need to be fighting those local election battles so people can see evidence that a vote for reform actually
makes a difference.
Makes a difference.
Yeah.
And so really the challenge for us is to take 2015, where there was very little national coverage, But there was a lot of activity on the ground in the local constituencies, and that 4 million votes. And then the 2024 election, where the local activity made remarkably little difference, but the national campaign really carried a lot of people. To bring those two things together, to turn that into the 8 or 9 million votes that we will need to form a government. And the reason I say 8 or 9 million votes is historically you're looking at more like 12 million votes to form a government. However, that's when you've got two main parties. Once you've got three main parties, depending on how those votes break down in individual constituencies, I expect that at the next general election, the winning party, whichever one it is, will be more in the range of 8 to 9 million.
There is discussion and there is thought at the moment that the danger is that we split the right wing parties. And I think this is entirely wrong, because I think even thinking these days about right and left, it's not the right way of thinking about politics. But there is this perception that there's a danger that we split the anti-Labour vote, if you like, and let Labour go through. And there's talk of the possibility of some kind of electoral pact whereby Reform take all the red walls, ex-red wall seats and take Labour out there, and we leave some of the other seats to the Conservatives. Now, I would be fundamentally opposed to that. What would your view be?
Well, I think it's wishful thinking. Wishful thinking by the Conservatives who feel under pressure. The Conservative Party is as much anathema to many Reform supporters as the Labour Party is. They're the ones that have allowed the migration debate to spiral to its present ridiculous level. They're the ones that brought in the net zero lunacy. And so a tidy deal between Reform and Conservatives isn't going to happen. And neither do I think it's required, because Reform, I see the evidence of shift from the Conservatives in the constituency of Crewe and Nantwich, where I have the honour to be the chairman. We are seeing that approach from Conservatives. We see in the last two MRP surveys Reform winning that seat. And where Conservatives, who are themselves genuine small c Conservatives, see that Reform is the place to best displace Labour, then in the same way that we lost votes in the last election, we will gain a flood of votes.
So we need no formal pact. We can trust people to tactically vote as they...
What we do after an election, when we know the facts on the ground as to how the people have spoken, and we can see that Reform have X number of MPs, Conservatives have Y number, and Labour have Z, and the Liberal Democrats and the Greens and so on and so forth. At that stage, if there's a requirement, because no one has an overall majority, then clearly all parties that have the interests of the United Kingdom at heart will wish to engage in the necessary discussions. But it's premature to engage in those discussions until the people have spoken. And I confidently expect that Reform will actually win the seats at the next general election, so that will be not required.
Well, we certainly have huge wind in our sails at the moment. And if that were to continue at the current sort of trajectory, by 2029, there would be no question that we would have an overall majority. Do you see any threats to that?
Well, there are a number of challenges that we face. I mean, the obvious threats are that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party get their act together and provide more effective
options. That wasn't the ones I was thinking about.
I rather dismiss those threats, because I don't actually have great confidence that either of those parties are capable.
The threat's going to be from ourselves. Oh. It's going to be missteps or mistakes that we make and that our leadership make. And as I said last week, I think we have made some already. But it's a question of how many more we're going to make before the election.
What Reform reform needs to demonstrate to the electorate of the United Kingdom is that it is a fit and proper party for government, because we need to attract a whole swathe of new voters who may have been sceptical of reform and its predecessor entities in the past. And in order to do that, we need to have clarity of purpose as to who is an acceptable reform candidate. So those people who feel offended that we haven't rushed to ally ourselves with Tommy Robinson, for example, are barking up the wrong tree. Tommy Robinson represents a strand of thought, a strand of approach, which is not aligned with Reform UK, and Reform needs to continue to be very clear about that. When it comes to other policy areas, there may well be differences, but when you see people on social media saying, well, if Reform doesn't support this, I'm out, and Reform hasn't supported that, and so that I'm off, it misses the point. No political party that achieves success has a body of supporters that all agree on everything. Life of Brian, I think, is a fantastic film in many ways with the allegories that it brings to life. And that scene in the Colosseum where the Judean Popular Front and the Popular Front for Judea and so on are sat there in ever-decreasing numbers is a recipe for an approach which will demonstrate failure.
I mean, I think it's a good thing that reform is not built on an ideology. And therefore, we can't be put, as individuals, can't be put to any kind of purity test to see if we pass it. The Tommy Robinson thing was an interesting one because whatever you think of him, and there are different views in terms of what he's doing now by comparison with what he perhaps did 20 years ago. I mean, I was reading up in my UKIP notes, and this isn't the first time Nigel actually resigned from UKIP. Because I think it was, what's the name of the guy? Batten.
Mm-hmm.
Gerard Batten admitted Tommy Robinson into the party. And that was the point. So Nigel left. So the antipathy is long-standing.
It's not necessarily a direct antipathy between Nigel and Tommy Robinson. It's that Tommy Robinson exudes an approach to politics and the UK body politic, that we want to pursue. And so, you know, it's not like they're butting heads individually because they're not in the same paradigm. Tommy Robinson is not a politician. He's he describes himself as a journalist. Well, that's fine. He should stick to his own métier. We at Reform cannot and do not want to align ourselves with him. That doesn't mean to say that people who may have sympathy for him should not vote for reform. But in the same way, we need to be a broad house and we need to accept a range of people who all have in their hearts what is best for Britain. Because that's, in a sense, what reform is about. It's restoring the political governance of Britain to something that actually backs Britain, that wants the best for this country and the people of this country. And that's all the people of this country. I don't myself look on that question of Englishness or Britishness as a question of the colour.
That's very fortunate, as I'm obviously Scottish.
Well, quite. But, in Scotland, very specifically, there isn't the same level of migration.
No.
Scotland has its own issues when it comes to nationality, and you will see regular reports of how elements within Scotland are not enamoured with English people who live.
As I said last week, I'm not a nationalist in that regard.
But there are many who are. But that sort of approach to nationalism is not where reform is in Scotland, in England, in Wales. The national identity that we want to promote is one that's a shared national identity, one that does pick up the traditional values, that does respect the role that Britain has played in the world, but allows other people who are willing to buy into that to become a part of it, as has been true for hundreds of years. When the Huguenots arrived from their political persecution in France, when the Jews came from Central Europe, and there are many other examples of that through history. Those people arrived with distinct identity, but all wanted to contribute to Britain. I mean, a more recent example...
Ugandan Asians.
I was just going to say Ugandan Asians. Oh, not East African Asians, more generally, because there were plenty from Kenya and Tanzania that came as well. So they are all good. And the Hong Kong Chinese who are coming here, these are all people who contributed to our economy and are willing to buy into our values. Underlying values. And so it's not the colour of your skin, but to paraphrase Martin Luther, it's what's written on your heart by which we should judge people.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thanks very much for that. It's been very good. I'd like to, we're time's getting on, so I would like to finish with a few questions which you can answer yes or no, if that's all right.
Yep.
So would you abolish the House of Lords?
I think the House of Lords need... Sorry, I can't answer yes or no.
Why not?
No, the House of Lords has been fundamentally destabilised by the changes which were brought in by Tony Blair. It is not currently fit for purpose. I'm not in favour of a unicameral parliament. I do think there needs to be a second chamber. I'm not personally convinced that a directly elected chamber is necessarily what you need, but I think that that debate needs to unfold. But certainly we need to have a second chamber, and it needs to be one that can apply the necessary revising function to the primary house.
Should we change our voting system to proportional representation?
Well, I think it... Right.
Proportional representation. Very well with these yes or no answers, am I?
Proportional representation covers a multitude of sins. There are bad proportional representation systems, and there are better proportional representation systems. What I think I can be absolutely clear about is the present first-the-past-post system has not delivered, particularly in a multi-party environment, a representative parliament, and we need to see change from that. Now, if you call that change proportional representation, great, but I think we need to be careful when we do that, that we don't fall out from the frying pan into the fire.
I'll keep trying. should we get a new model for the NHS?
The NHS does need fundamental change.
Should we lock down again in a future pandemic?
Perhaps the worst effect of that lockdown is that it precludes that policy option in the event that something really did warrant lockdown. Now, if you've got a different virus that is highly contagious and fatal across the whole spectrum of ages, then...
But would you trust the establishment to tell you the truth?
Well, that's the problem. I think it'd be very difficult to deliver that precisely because the trust from the establishment is not there. And I mean, I think really what I'd say about that is that no lockdown should exclude free speech on the subject, and that government in making those decisions should be open to the widest range of expert opinion and shouldn't just constrain itself to those experts that they happen to have chose. I mean, I actually think the lockdown policy was an appalling aberration that failed in its own objectives and was wrong at every level and has had a really negative impact on the economy. So am I completely opposed to the last lockdown? Yes. But never in life say never, because it could be at some stage in the future something comes along, maybe something that's manufactured by people deliberately.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but I don't think it's, you know, I think it's the trust.
Well, because that trust has been destroyed, it would be awfully difficult to go down that path again. And that in itself is a pity. I mean, in the past, we had quarantine hospitals behind barbed wire. In fact, they were all discontinued. I remember going to pick somebody up from one that had actually not been in use as an isolation hospital, but it still had all the barbed wire fences and so on around it. And you can see back in the day, we did take that isolation of virulent cases very seriously. Indeed. Well, if you look at it with dogs, look at the way we used to control rabies infection in this country. And that actually served us quite well. Although I do note that since those controls were taken, we haven't got a rampant rabies
don't seem to have.
Across the country.
Only in one political party.
Oh, yeah.
Should we abolish the Supreme Court?
The Supreme Court in its present guise should be abolished. But the answer to that slightly depends on your answer on the House of Lords, because it all part of restoring primacy to Parliament, and we should not have a Supreme Court that adjures to itself the ability to override Parliament.
Should we repeal the Equalities Act?
Yes.
Should we repeal the Climate Act?
Yes.
Should we abolish the Arts Council?
We should abolish pretty well every quango we can find. I'm struggling to think of an exception, but at least at the start...
Well, my absolutely favourite one is the Arts Council. Because why, if we have no money, as everybody keeps telling us, why are we expecting hard-working people to pay the taxation in order to fund George Osborne's seat at the Royal Opera?
Well, the only way I'd come back at that to say is that although I take your point, it doesn't actively harm the economy in a macro way.
Should we build on the Greenbelt?
We shouldn't have governments that create conditions where pressure to build on the Greenbelt is forced on local communities. I do believe that local communities should make the decisions about development in their own areas. But the overriding factor in this is the failure of our migration policies. If you bring millions of additional people into this country, you will necessarily dislocate the housing market. So if we are able, and I believe reform would, to exercise tight control over migration so that we don't generate the spiralling demand, then we can more safely leave those decisions. But we also need to remove the other obstacles to fulfilment of housing need. The various ways in which government is creating burdens for landlords and disincentives for people to entering into the housing market are creating the conditions where the government is going round and round in circles trying to solve a problem that it's created itself. So, in abstract, I am not broadly in favour of development on Greenbelt. I think that local communities should be allowed to make decisions that affect themselves, and national government should not be creating the conditions.
The only problem with that, Nick, is that what you find in practice is if you say that local people should be able to make decisions, is that whenever any planning application comes through, almost inevitably they say no, because they don't want more housing in their area because that devalues the price of their house, and they don't know who's going to move into the other houses. And so, and they, obviously, they would then take up doctors' places and hospital places, et cetera, et cetera. Well, so whenever you put a planning application to local people, say, oh, we have a new housing development down the road, they always say no.
Well, not necessarily. I spent some years in different parts of the country as chairman of parish councils and as member of parish councils. So I'm well aware of the local feelings that arise about these developments. And part of the problem is people wish to impose the wrong developments at the wrong place at the wrong time. If you ask people, should we be able to give planning permission for local people to and local builders to make small-scale developments which are sympathetic to the area, particularly if they incorporate housing provision for local people who might not otherwise be able to stay in the area, and you go with the grain of the local community, then it's much easier to get that permission. If you decide I'm going to parachute down from space, a development of 560 houses, and plonk it on the field behind you, then it's not very surprising that people don't like it. Yeah. So I don't have the same feelings of denigration for local communities which you see from government ministers. They're suffering from the frustration of the policy imperatives that they've created themselves through their failures across that broad range of policies, such as migration, which I pointed out before. So frankly, those government ministers attempting to impose that development on the Green Belt have only themselves to blame.
Good. Well, that's not a one-word answer, but it's a very comprehensive answer. And can I thank you for it?
My pleasure.
And can I thank you very much for coming today? It's been a most interesting. I found it a very interesting discussion. I hope that the viewers...
I enjoy myself, yes.
Yeah. Good. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
I want my country back, and the country I'm talking about would not tolerate this nonsense.
But now you have a choice. There is a party that will represent you and stand up for common sense.
And when the dam bursts, it will do so spectacularly.
I overturned the biggest ever Conservative majority of 25,500 people.
But if Britain is broken, then logically, Britain needs reform.